advantages given our history of capital equipment into the mining sector. We have that capacity, but until we are able to work closely with the Transnet National Ports Authority to secure the right value proposition, including with respect to the Port of Saldanha, which speaks to issues of land, concessions to operate, customs, tariff issues, frankly speaking, we're going to miss the boat. Walvis Bay, Maputo, and notwithstanding some other constraints, African ports are stealing a march on us, which for obvious reasons we can ill afford. The opportunities, lastly, Madam Chair, I've spoken about these relate to the large public sector infrastructure program, metals, capital and transport equipment. We need to deepen and embed supply development policies in the state-owned companies, improve the impact assessment and policy improvement for aligned procurement policy instruments. That's the supply development, the designations, and as well as the NIP. And we are working on, as Zuki said, including with UNIDO, a much better instrument to try and measure the impact of what's actually happening. It's not easy because you can't simply take data off the Treasury or the national system of accounts. A lot of this is firm level data in terms of capacity upgrading, new jobs and so on and so forth. There's a very significant opportunity to grow our manufacturing exports to net food importing countries. That would be in the Gulf, in the Middle and Far East, Indonesia, China, and so on and so forth. As well as with respect to sub-Saharan African countries, not only mining infrastructure and construction, but also growing our exports to what hopefully will eventually become a single export market and for our considerable capacity in agro-processing of consumer goods. And then, Madam Chair, notwithstanding gains, which Zuki spoke to, much stronger enforcement and alignment with customs on fraud and illegal imports and non-compliant products, which means there has to be very close coordination with SAPS, with customs, with the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, for pre-border interventions, as well as post-border raids on non-compliant products. Madam Chair, shortly there will be the launch of a much ramped up Buy South Africa campaign with strong private sector commitments to buy local, where business, labor and the private sector will announce this campaign. As I've said, the finalization of the biofuels regulatory regime we hope will go through, and we are confident we'll create 100,000 jobs. And if we get it right with respect to our competitive advantage in minerals endowment, this could represent a very significant opportunity. We have employed a team of experts through the IDC to look at 5 value chains, not just with respect to yet another high-level strategy, but actually to identify the manufacturing opportunities in 5 value chains, from the PGM minerals through steel and plastics and polymers. Madam Chair, very, very briefly, I have already spoken to that slide. That's the electricity tariff increases. This slide tells an important story. As our competitors are ramping down, if that's the right term, pushing down administered prices, that's the BRIC apologize. This source is not respective statistical bureaus. This graph is prepared by the manufacturing sector and Iraj Abedian. So there's a correction to that slide. Madam Chair, I thought I should just put this on because a number of analysts suggest that the IPEP is scaling up industrial tariffs. In fact, that gives you a very clear indication that our industrial tariffs are amongst the lowest in the world. And we've been very careful to ensure that in our designation process, those products used as intermediate products into manufacturing, steel, plastics, and polymers, are not designated local because the monopoly producers of those products are practicing export parity pricing and, in fact, not allowing a competitive advantage to our manufacturing sectors. That's the PMI hovering at around 50%. Come up a little bit, but there are still signs which suggest that there is deep unease in the manufacturing sector. That's the manufacturing monthly production and year-on-year growth, which shows extreme volatility for a range of factors, but again, is cause for concern. Manufacturing utilization, in some cases as a direct result of the price of electricity, went steadily south with the onset of the recession, and that obviously is an additional factor, but we know that in key energy-intensive sectors, foundries and so on and so forth, the price of electricity is a factor. That's the trade balance, which perhaps is the most alarming figure of all. The green part of that slide shows massive imports. We believe, as we've said before, driven by credit extension and household consumption in the main of imported manufactured value-added products. That's also alarming, and the critical factor there is the RIA, the real effective exchange rate, which is amongst the highest in the world. The real effective exchange rate. Then manufacturing employment also going south. And that brings me, I think, to the end of the presentation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, DDG Strachan. I mean, there's some very heartening news here, but also information that we will need to unpack and address. We just see by a show of hands on both sides of the room, we had the Honourable James, the Honourable Ma Vasa, the Honourable Ntuli, the Honourable Hill Lewis, the Honourable Van der Merwe, the Honourable Khadebe. Oh, Honourable Sotoli. Are you ready on the DTI side to take a note of the questions? Because we'll have those six by the look of things and get responses before going into further. Well, Wilmot James.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you very, very much for your presentation. There's a lot in here, and it's very interesting mix of, shall we call it, business welfare and building on assets through very innovative investments. So thank you very much for that. I mean, it really gives one a real grasp of both what it is that we are developing as a country and what the challenges are and the difficulties. So thanks very much. There are a few things that really excite me. The renewal of railroad rolling stock, I think that's fabulous. I think that's to be greatly welcomed. The focus on renewable energy, I think, is fabulous. And I'm very pleased with the development of what's happening in the pharmaceutical sector and vaccine development as well. So those stand out for me, and there are many others, but I just thought I'd mention those as items to be welcomed. I had one question and then a comment to make. And the question was about what the cost drivers are at our ports, because we know what the problem is in terms of the numbers. But I'm not sure how we get to those numbers and what it is we can be done strategically to drive those costs down. So that was my question. My comment was that it's clearly in the national interest to keep administered prices down, and that there has to be some kind of pact between business and labor and government to keep administered prices down in order to keep jobs at least, if not stagnant, get them to grow as well. And there are two interesting experiments that were held in Germany and in the Netherlands, which was to introduce what's known as a cost reduction caucus. It's like a NEDLAC, but the purpose of the NEDLAC is to get agreement between business and labor and government to keep prices down in the national interest in terms of jobs. It has worked there, I believe. I don't know it in detail, but it's something that you might want to look at. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair, and Mr. Sahan, thank you very much, together with the young daughter there. Well done. I want to appreciate as well the quality of progress from where IPEP was, you know, in terms of the previous inputs that we received. So it shows that huge strides have been covered. But sometimes when help is given to industry, the focus tends to be on the big players. And unconsciously, you may find that the small players, particularly the emerging entrepreneurs, and more particularly those that were previously out of the, you know, the major market players, I mean, in productive terms, they tend to be forgotten, you know, because it's not easy for them to come to the government. Even when government advertises through media, you find it tends to miss those that are quite at the bottom there. And there is the example that I usually give and say, with industrial parks that are, some of them are in Soweto and some of them are in Tshwane. Examples of those in Soweto, there is the Orlando Industrial Park, Mdeni, Dobsonville. If government does not consciously go to them, we will find that we will not close the gap, the economic gap between the haves and the have-nots, you know, in industry. And the input on iron and steel, it makes me wonder whether we still think it was a good decision to move it away from government production to private sector. You know, shouldn't we ask ourselves that question? And the one but last, cooperatives. I have not heard anything about cooperatives in empowering of businesses. And that's one component where, or that's one instrument that would address the inequities that we are having, and it will also tend to benefit many instead of government assistance going to individuals. So I don't know how far the department has thought about that. This last one is on training and institutions, because we complain that the training institutions give us an irrelevant product. So I just hope that as we advance in the manner we are indicating, alongside we are working with training institutions, so that we don't find down the line we don't have people to maintain the very products that we are producing. Thanks, Colin Chair.
Thank you very much. I think it may be just important, I may not have mentioned the Chief Director's name, but it is Ms. Zukiswa Pai, Chief Director. Right, Honourable Ntuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson, and I would also like to welcome the presentation. Chairperson, I want to check why do we have inadequate provision of suitable long-term financial instruments, because we've got the IPC, but I would like to, if you can elaborate on that one. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, thank you very much. I think that was one of the slides that DDG struck, and you cut a little bit short, you indicated, that maybe you ought to expand on it again. Thank you, Honourable Ntuli. Honourable Hill-Lewis?
Thanks, Chair. Just to check, in the document we received, there was a progress report on NIP. But it wasn't in the presentation. Is there going to be a secondary presentation, or do I ask on that now?
Well, I think we heard that the chief director under whom NIP falls, am I correct? I'm so sorry, I don't seem to have just got your name then, so I do apologize. If you'd give... Yes?
It's Masizaki, Honorable Chair. Masizaki Zimela.
Thank you. Right. If you, you know, it is here, it can be taken account of, obviously within the IPAP arrangements here.
Okay, great. Well, I'll start with the questions on the presentation then, Chair. Firstly, the USA legislation, thank you very much for the presentation. Firstly, DDG Strachan and Chief Director Kapai, thank you very much. The USA legislation requiring that all inbound containers to US ports be scanned, which I think is going to be implemented from 2013, that has the potential to add new significant costs to outbound containers from our ports. What progress are we making in readying our ports for that legislation? Because I presume ports around the world are going to have to ready themselves for it, because we all do a lot of trade with the USA. Secondly, sir, with regards to public procurement, government procurement, it was surprising to me, or I would love to see vehicles on that list of identified products for preferential local procurement, because government is undoubtedly one of the biggest purchasers of vehicles. And we have a huge variety of very good vehicles that are made right here in South Africa. And it would be nice, as part of the Buy South Africa program and as part of your preferential local procurement program, to see us buying South African-made vehicles. And perhaps that may even stave off the Mercedes problem you were talking about. Then your report... report, your slightly longer report that we got, speaks of an enterprise investment program as an incentive program, but there's not much detail on it. I did do a quick Google on your website, couldn't find much on it, so if you could just let me know a little bit about what that is and what it offers. Enterprise investment program. And then, sir, on ITAC, the report talks about 18 requests for protective tariffs or tariff increases having been processed by ITAC. But we've seen very public complaints by at least the poultry manufacturers and the olive oil growers and manufacturers, olive growers and olive oil manufacturers, about having submitted applications and the time period for those applications having lapsed because of no response from ITAC, which I believe the time period is 6 months. So I'd like to know, over and above the 18 that have been processed, how many applications were received? That 18, what percentage of the total number of applications is that? And then finally, your presentation is very frank about the problems that we have with administered prices and inefficiencies in our ports, and I appreciated that. But it does seem that a great stumbling block to progress in your strategy and in your mandate are problems with state-owned entities. And Honorable Mabasa was asking about this as well. What specifically are you guys doing to engage with those entities and other government departments to try and remove those blockages? Because really, they do seem quite severe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then we move to, just let me get my list, Honorable van der Merwe.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the DG and the Chief DDG and the Chief Director. I also wanted to talk about what other colleagues have talked about, and that is the whole question of two full slides on intragovernmental issues of concern. And I've raised this before in this committee, because really, the Industrial Policy Action Plan is a government plan led by the DTI, but we have to have some way in which we can speed up these things, these problems, resolving of these problems. And I think that the presentation alludes to work that's being done through the little bullet points on which lead department is taking it forward and so on. But then I quite liked also the idea about the cost reduction caucus. I thought that was suggested by the Honourable James. I think we should have some kind of a caucus that gets rid of these blockages and so that we don't have problems in aquaculture because of EIAs. If it's in the strategy, it should be happening. Because what I think is alarming is the fact that we are busy being overtaken by many countries in Africa, not only because of our bad port access and high prices, but in a range of areas where other countries are just going ahead. But ours seem to be constrained by ourselves. And I really think that needs some attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable van der Merwe. And now if we can have Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll also follow my colleagues in appreciating the presentations as they were given this afternoon. But these presentations, Chairperson, actually provide the background of the tale of the two cities, where we are living in the best of times, also in the worst of times. So why do I say that we are living in the best of times? Is that we are having these wide resources we are sitting on, the mineral resources. But at the same time, as my colleague, Honorable Mabasa, has said, those wide resources do not benefit the people who are supposed to be benefiting. So that's the problem. So the other aspect is the issue which was raised, is that in the Industrial Policy Action Plan, we really appreciate the amount of money which the government is pumping in jacking up the industry. But what guarantees does it have that as it pumps that money into those companies, as they benefit, the workers also equally benefit? I'll make an example. The clothing and textile lendo industry. We have presentations from the unions which are representing that sector. They are crying about the exploitation. They are crying about the people having to sign off that they are abdicating themselves from the Labor Relations Act. They are no longer good. So those things are in black and white. I did see that. So how to ensure that as we put this money in, at the end, the decent work comes out, not slavery. I think that part. Also, Chairperson, as Honorable Fanar Merve and Honorable Hill Lewis have said, there's a problem here within government itself. Really, when you look at the issue of the port charges, you look at the issue of the electricity, those are state entities. The issue is, why are they out of sync with this program? Why are they out of sync with this program? So, Chairperson, I don't know whether is it the high time. You know, I recall when we're moving towards the 2010 World Cup, all the state entities were made to march in one line. There was an exodus past there. They were all made to march in one line. Is it not the high time now? Is it not now time now that even at the economic front, we have to come with that martial law, which is going to ensure that everyone marches in one step? Because from what I'm seeing, Comrade Chair, you know, around 2010, 2009, iron ore, its price was at peak. India wanted our iron ore. China wanted our iron ore, whatever. But the prices we were getting during that time, what was happening during that time is the saga of the steel industry, is that we never benefited as a country, but we are lying on these reserves. So is it not the high time that we come with a strong law which is going to make these people to march in one, in synchronization with this thing? And Chair, the other part is the issue of the Department of Home Affairs. That one happened in my constituency, Chairperson. We had an Indian company opening sunflower oil firm in Villiers, somewhere in the Free State. Those guys, they had nightmares in getting the papers to work. They had nightmares. They were investing. But they had nightmares. So the issue now of this intra-governmental relationship, because really, if we've got investors who are coming in, and then I'm going to have problems with the papers. Because that guy was going to say that if he had left the country, he was not going to get the visa to come back. There was that nightmare. You move from pillar to post. Are those things there somewhere to ease this issue of land? Of investment?
Thank you very much, Honorable Khadebe. Now, we said we'd have six, but we do still then have another just in the middle of talking, yeah. So I think what we need to do is take the second round, starting with Sotoli, Coleman, Honourable Sotoli, Honourable Coleman, Honourable Salah, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Khabasa. Hang on. Sotetsi, Honourable Sotetsi, and Gamedi, yeah. Honourable Gamedi, right. And there you see we'll have our... Well, you don't really know yet, do you, Honourable Hildus? I mean, it could be... No, quiet. Right. Mr. Strachan, DDG Strachan, it's over to yourself and your team at the moment. That's the first tranche of questions, that's all. If you could respond to those, you can field with your team the most suitable person. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I'll have a crack first as briefly as I can. With respect to Honourable James's question, what are the cost drivers at the ports? I think it would be, by way of a suggestion, quite useful for the committee to get the Transnet National Ports Authority in to get a better understanding of it. There obviously are cost drivers, including infrastructure, and some of the infrastructure at the ports is old and has to be upgraded. But I don't think that's the central problem. The central problem is the fact, in my understanding, and I can't speak for the National Ports Authority, is that in fact what's happening is that the Transnet is cross-subsidizing loss-leading sections of its business with high port charges. So those high port charges subsidize other parts of the operation. But from our perspective, that is a perverse incentive, because you should be not necessarily providing subsidies, because that's illegal in terms of the WTO, but your charges for the export of value-added manufactured products should be as low as possible, and certainly not higher than imports and higher than the exports of primary commodities, which in effect are subsidized. The cheapest thing to do is to export coal and iron ore, dirt out of the ground. The most expensive thing to do is to export manufactured products, and this is a very, very significant constraint on our exports. I'm not going to comment, with your permission, Madam Chair, on the social compact issue. I mean, I think, other than to say that, you know, it's a very important practice which is practiced in various parts of the world, not only Germany, but Ireland and so on and so forth. With respect to the question of Honourable Mabasa, as much as cooperatives and small companies are hugely important, we have to recognize that the role of large companies in manufacturing is absolutely significant. And you have to just look at the Japanese examples or South Korea, where there was extremely close linkages and support between the state and the large domestic industrial companies. And if we get that right, then into the value chains, into the supply chains and the, in other words, the demand side as well as all the supply side, you then get a proliferation of small companies providing inputs into those large companies, as I've tried to say, or benefiting from the downstream services and so on and so forth. So, you know, the Industrial Development Division doesn't deal with small companies. That's other parts of the DTI, enterprise development and economic empowerment. And so, you know, perhaps it might be useful for you to get that division in if you haven't already done so. I think we would fully support the idea that clusters are absolutely important. And if one part of the DTI's support for small and medium companies has been successful, it is in clusters where you provide infrastructure, you can provide training, you can provide support to clusters of companies in value chains. The big problem is we've got 40 clusters. Brazil has 4,020 clusters supported by the state, and they're very successful. And so that's an area that, if I'm to express in a personal opinion we have to get into, although that doesn't fall under our particular division. The nationalization of ISCO, I'm afraid I'm going to duck that question. It's a political question, and I have personal views on it, but perhaps it's an unfair question, Madam Chair. What I would say is that what we've ended up with is a privately owned monopoly that is providing the most important intermediate product into the manufacturing sector at export parity pricing instead of a developmental steel price. As an intermediate input, steel, whether it's flat steel, roll coil, or whatever your niche steel product, that essentially is 70% of inputs into the manufacturing sector. Plastics, polymers, leather, and so on and so forth make up all the other elements. But it's a potential massive competitive advantage, which for the last, whatever it is, 10 years, has not been a competitive advantage. In fact, it's been a huge disadvantage to manufacturing. And so it obviously is a priority. With respect to Member Ntuli's question, the inadequate provision of long-term financing, I think the central question there is the fact that if we look at the IDC's financing model, apart from issues of risk aversion, the central question is, notwithstanding certain recent movement in the right direction, there are two problems. The IDC works off its balance sheet like a private sector company, and therefore, relative to key peer competitors, the cost of industrial financing in South Africa is high. And perhaps more importantly, the term of financing is very short. So on average, it's about 7 years. So if you went to your bank and you asked them for a mortgage to buy a house and they said, sure, we'll give you one, but you've got to pay it back in 7 years, you would fall off the chair. And so that's the problem. I don't have the figures on the top of my head, but it's something like, on average, our term of financing is between 5 and 7 years. And not for quoting, but I think India is 14 years and Brazil is 18 years. When you buy a house, you get a mortgage for 21 years. And so the problem essentially is that the Brazilian National Development Bank is recapitalized on an annual basis by the state, whereas the Industrial Development Corporation works purely off its balance sheet. There are issues of risk aversion as well, and when there is risk aversion, unfortunately, there is very often a parallel process where even unconsciously, so to speak, there is support not for manufacturing, but for other sectors, services, banking services, mining, where the returns are higher, over a shorter period of time, and where returns are much less in the manufacturing sector, there is, obvious risk associated with it. With respect to Honourable Hill Lewis's question, my understanding, and I'd have to get a clearer picture of this from my colleague Sukiswa Napai is in charge of this work, I would have to speak to SARS and Customs. But as we speak, my understanding is that the US is already involved in processes which examine containers at the port of export. And so I think we are very well placed to be able to handle that, although I have to say that I speak hesitantly on this question, and SARS would be the best people to give you a definitive picture. We are working, secondly, Honourable Hill Lewis, on the issue of an examination of the potential to designate vehicles for local procurement. We go through a very long process, including stakeholder engagement, when we procure any for local procurement, when we designate. And so we don't designate without very significant research of the likely impacts and stakeholder engagement, and that process is underway at the moment. I would like to say, however, that the biggest manufacturer of medium heavy commercial vehicles, which is a very important South African owned original equipment manufacturer, which is Bell, which is based at Richards Bay, that the new APDP will include Bell and those medium heavy commercial vehicle manufacturers into the bouquet of incentives available for autos. With respect to ITAC, the issue that you raised about poultry and the complaints from the poultry producers may be a very instructive one, because as is required in terms of the regulations of the Independent Tariff Arbitration Council, or is it committee, ITAC, under the WTO agreements and regulations, industry has to apply, not the DTI, for a raising of tariffs or for a range of other measures. One of those measures is something called countervailing or anti-dumping duties. Now, the poultry manufacturers applied for anti-dumping against Brazil, and ITAC put in place an interim anti-dumping tariff. Brazil immediately went to the World Trade Organization and won. And so, you know, I would suggest that manufacturers need to be careful about laying charges of inefficiency against ITAC, because ITAC correctly has to go through a very due and proper process. Because when no country, including the BRICS countries, will allow a precedent for anti-dumping duties to be instituted, because then it can roll out to a whole lot of other products. So rest assured, if you put anti-dumping duties on whoever it is, that country is going to come for you. And they came for us, and we lost. Ironically, and this is perhaps an indictment on the poultry industry, but also reflects negatively on the DTI, the so-called water between the bound and applied rate for poultry products, we could have lifted the tariffs without going for an anti-dumping or countervailing duty and then losing it. So part of the problem is that you're dealing, and obviously the tariff regime has been significantly simplified under the DTI, and ITAC now falls under EDD. But nevertheless, it's very complicated. There are 4,000 tariff items, and so we rely on our sector desk to monitor where there's space between the bound and applied rate. But we also rely on industry associations to be doing some homework and say, well, we're under pressure, we've looked at the tariffs, there's some room to lift the tariffs, let's put in an application as an industry association for a raising of tariffs. And where there are examples where ITAC is moving slowly, may I say through you, Madam Chair, that we're happy to receive calls and emails on that, and we'll intervene immediately with ITAC to have an open door policy. And I have to say with respect that my opinion is that they're working very efficiently. But what I don't have, and I undertake to provide that, is how many applications they've received, how long it took them to deal with those applications, and how quickly did they get back to the applicants, including with respect to issues which are very, very difficult. The glass, auto glass industry, for example, wants a countervailing duty on imported auto glass from China. Now, to prove an anti-dumping or countervailing, you've got to be able to prove that in terms of the WTO, that there's significant subsidies being applied to the export of those products into South Africa. So it's a very difficult process. I can only agree with Honourable van der Merwe and wouldn't comment further. With respect to Honourable Khadebe, I don't think any of the incentives, and there's a very big bouquet of incentives, which include, I beg your pardon, Honourable Hill Lewis, the EIP, which is an enterprise investment program to assist companies. Maybe Zuki can add to it, but it's essentially a startup program to assist companies with investments for capital and other equipment. I would send you, if you give me your email, the full bouquet of all the incentives and how they apply. I don't think any incentives are done without very strong consultation with the National Treasury and with the stakeholders involved. Obviously, private sector companies would want as many incentives as they could get. But that engagement includes engagement in each case with the unions, and in the case of the clothing and textile competitiveness program incentives, as far as I know, unless it's changed very recently, the union SACTU is fully behind the incentives, and in fact at NEDLAC fully supported the incentives. It may be that there are factories where there are labor practices which are in breach of labor law, but I think that needs to be taken up with the Department of Labor. And in fact, not only are there strong conditionalities to prevent rent seeking in all of the incentives, but there is also strong monitoring and evaluation. And that strong monitoring and evaluation is done both by the DTI and the IDC, which manage the incentives for the autos, clothing and textiles sectors, amongst others. But there is also benchmarking which is done by UNIDO, so that when a company receives X incentive for competitiveness upgrading, the monitoring and evaluation teams that visit the factory can have a benchmark for the competitiveness, so that they're not just benchmarking. They're not just evaluating that company in a vacuum. It's based on a global benchmarking carried out by UNIDO. And so if there are examples of rent seeking where a company receives an incentive and the managing director has bought a motorboat or an overseas holiday
answered, Honourable Khadebe, you raised the issue of home affairs as well. Remember the challenges. I know at one stage the minister did indicate that they were aware of that and had been having a bilateral with home affairs on that matter.
We have a team of people in the DTI, if I understand your question properly, who work very closely with home affairs. Home affairs will grant visas, in my understanding, after very strict consultation with the DTI, where there are scarce skills, where those scarce skills can't be accessed into South Africa, and where, unless those jobs are filled, it's a binding constraint on the development of that sector. And so that is also informed by what sector it is. So to give you an example, and this is a real example, we get an application for work permits in the service, banking services sector. It's 99% certain that the DTI would say no. Our banking services sector is very mature. We don't believe that there are areas where there are skill shortages which act as a binding constraint, unlike, say, engineers in other sectors of the economy. But if you wanted, Honorable Khadebe, an understanding of how many work permits have been granted, in which sectors, for what reasons, I'm afraid you would have to ask the Department of Home Affairs. We act only in an advisory capacity, and I can assure you, because they pass over my desk, that we do not recommend work permits where there are available South African skills.
Thank you very much, GDG. What we're going to do now is to, we did have another list, Honourable Satori, Honourable Coleman, Honourable Salah, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Sortetsi, Honourable Gamedi, Honourable Hill-Lewis. All right? In that order. So we have Honourable Satori, please. And apologies to you. You did have your hand up. Wabasa, I know. Thank you. Sorry. Yes, Honourable Satori.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I really want to thank you for a very enlightening briefing. I'm worried by two things. Beneficiation. I happen to be a student of Ben Churok. We go to the class there. And I got this information that we are the world's best endowed country with minerals. And they said it was discovered by some American bank, something like that. There was a report to that effect. But I asked the question, why are we not having the jobs? The answer was that it's the problem is beneficiation, because in South Africa we've got a different meaning of the word beneficiation. We take the ore from the ground, clean it, and send it for further beneficiation outside the country where it creates the jobs. I mean, we're 18 years in government and we are aware of this thing. And the objective of government is to fight joblessness in the country. Why are we, as this department, not coming up with a legislation that would actually compel serious beneficiation in South Africa, because that would answer all our problems, joblessness. We can't have a lot of resources that means nothing to ourselves. That is one. Because we know about this thing, we have the resources, so why not legislate? That is one. The second one, I also in that class, we were informed that there is a professor who is a well-known professor. They call him Professor Stichner. I can't pronounce that name, but I can write it. Stigler. Yeah. Yes. He said in one conference, I think some 2-3 months back, that South Africa has got about 80% of the world's platinum. And he said, you have got the monopoly of the platinum. Why are you playing free market? If we have the monopoly, why are we not charging enough to actually make sure that we show that we've got it, 80% of the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I must say it brushed up my own knowledge from the class, so refresher course. But on a more serious note, yes, I see Honourable Coleman is not here, but Honourable Tsotetsi, you're from that same committee, and please take this opportunity.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the funding by IDC, to what extent does the department interrogate processes to ensure the effectiveness of the transformation policy so that you don't continue to benefit the previously advantaged at the detriment of the previously disadvantaged? And again, as far as final approvals are concerned, what would be the most reasonable time frame or time to approve an application? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Salah.
Thanks, Chair. I'm sorry that I'm going to try to take part of my first round as well. The one area is the issue of South African workers, especially South African young people. And we all understand the situation in South Africa in respect to South Africa being the economic hub of SADC. How do we ensure that the majority of the jobs we create, one way or the other? I know in football what they do is to avoid having the whole club being played by foreign players. They have a quota to say you can field at a time only up to the maximum of 5. Then the rest must be home-based players. In this case, is there any kind of a scenario that you thought of in dealing with the situation that can address the home base local children to be able to get a job without being seen as being xenophobic at the same time? As I'm asking this question again and again, I'm not really getting comfort in answers I'm getting. And as regards foreign investment incentives, do we have the same incentives for foreign investors as we would have for local investors? That's that area. I want to just take this time to go to page 11 of the presentation, which deals with key achievements and focuses on the automotive industry. I have two questions there. One question is, and I have asked this question in the previous presentation as well. Are we able to quantify progress in this respect? For instance, we have the last dash. Well, it's not bullet. The last dash on that page talks about the rollout of AIS has been going on in support of approximately 63,003 jobs. Inclusive in that is the 7,858 project jobs. What is not clear to me here is that are we saying these jobs are already there with people in them, or is then this target is a target we intend to achieve? And if it is a target we intend to achieve, how much of it have we been able to achieve so far? By quantifying, you know, I want us to feel a sense of whether we're talking figures sitting here, but on the ground nothing is happening, or we can confidently begin to go out there and talk to our people to say, even if the jobs have not reached you, there is progress going on. There are these things happening around your life. My second question here is the issue of localization. To assemble a car, fortunately I've been in that industry, you don't manufacture these things that you put together to get a car. Different manufacturers are doing these things. There are tire companies that are doing tires. You have your glass companies for your windscreens and other windows. You have your body parts companies for your bonnets, doors and boots and bumpers. And you have your leather seats companies that are manufacturing the seats and putting them leather, or if not leather, they put the other cover. And you have your paint companies that are selling you the different kinds of paints that you use in your paint shops, and other parts that are there in the car. Your sparings and your cable for electrification and so on and so forth. Now, I'm asking this question, and you are going to see it coming in different styles as I go on. How do we talk about incentivizing the automobile industry? Are we referring only to the assembly, to the exclusion of those? And, you know, beyond building it, you also have your petrol stations, you have your spares, where this car gets damaged, spares get bought in those areas, and all of these other things where a car gets serviced and get motion from. All of those are linked to that, and they create jobs one way or the other. How far are we going with that particular area? I just want to get clarity. Let's not take that to be difficult questions. Now, coming to the clothing, I will try to summarize them. Clothing, sector, agro-processing, I'm summarizing, can you see that? And then metal fabrication, all of those three. Are we talking only to manufacturing? In other words, the raw material. Where do we get, how do we deal with the raw material? Are we prepared to go to the extent of importing raw material to come and manufacture? Or do we look at the process of the production of the raw material to assist this production to come out? Because to produce is a production company, you first get raw material in, convert it, put it together into specifications and size and what have you, and get the final product. Again, now, this raw material, where does it come from, and how do we influence that it should be localized and produce jobs?
Can't wait for the long version.
I think Honorable allow no
I'm just starting. I've just asked three questions. No,
but you have had 7 minutes. You know.
I said I would take part of the.
Yeah.
But
you see, I cut Honourable Hill Lewis, who was also getting into his stride, into his 4th minute, and I chopped him. It, as you will. Now, thank you. Right. Honourable McIntosh, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few short questions, but I do have a few. Can we, first of all, can I say that it's wonderful to have five pages. I'm sorry, what's the problem, Madam Chair?
Making a light remark, I said, must we count the preamble as part of the short?
You know, Madam Chair, Mr. Khadebe mentioned slavery. I think you must have been a slave driver in a previous existence. Madam Chair, I just want to thank these guys for the 5 pages of acronyms and abbreviations, because I think I would have battled to understand a lot of stuff if I couldn't have quickly looked up those numbers. Can I just ask a few very short questions? On page 7 at the bottom, where you've got your emerging organic farmer retailer program, I did see a report somewhere that Walmart are now quite actively getting involved. Are they or are they not? And are you aware of it? Your mention of Food Corp, also on, it's actually the little slide 13 on page 7, is that a reference to your assistance to Food Corp in retaining the Omar Rusk factory in Maltino in the northeastern Cape? Then at the bottom of that same little thing, you've got a furniture strategy and action plan. Is that connected to the Steinhoff factory in Ugi, where there's been a magnificent development of adding value to forestry products? The reference to the workshops, Transnet workshops, I presume that's referring to the Silverton facility, which existed, or am I mistaken, or maybe you name it after some other suburb. Esteris, I think, is next door to it. And then could you explain the recent announcement of Chinese locomotives being imported there's something like 110 that they just placed an order. Is there any local content in those locomotives? And then where you talk about a tooling apprenticeship, also still on little page 14, 520 decisions, is that the tooling centre I've read about at Ngoha in Port Elizabeth or not? And then where is the Amazon African Customer Service Centre in Cape Town? Where can I pop in and have a look at it? Okay, Woodstock. Okay, thank you. And then the last thing which you were proud about in Green Industries, 2 rounds of renewable energy generation bids. Madam Chair, what I would like to point out is there's been no financial closure on those bids. We went to COP17 showing off. But the Department of Energy, and I know it's not Trade and Industries, but I think Trade and Industry should be aware of it, that in fact it's a huge failure. And in terms of our status internationally, energy and everything, it's not too different from sewerage in the streets of a free state town. That whole bid system, they had to transfer it, but government have handled it very badly. Thank you. That's all, Madam Chair. And the Honourable James will be very pleased to know it.
Can I just ask you, Honourable McIntosh, what page is the, the COP reference?
I'm just saying, it's not, they didn't refer to it. It's on page 8, little page 15. But all I'm saying is we at COP17 said we were going to do all this, but we haven't because people cannot get to financial closure because we haven't got all the compliance in place, largely because of Eskom and NERSA?
Perhaps on a light, well, it's not such a light note, but I think Honourable Kadebe had indicated earlier that I think it was the sports, it was yourself and how we'd all got together and what it brought us. And in a way, I suppose, having a whip to have run that, we needed even more than that, and the whip is good in Parliament, but it may be that one needed a particular industrial sort of sergeant major, not the slave driver, Honourable McIntosh, but more the, you know, the parade ground issue. All right. Okay, getting into battle, as it were. Honourable James, you just interjected there or tried to?
Well, on a light note, you know, I simply want to ask the question whether there's really a material difference between five short questions and one long question.
I actually, you know, I looked at this, the preamble alone, difficult where to place it, but on the other hand, I must thank you, Honourable McIntosh. You always do keep us alert. Those of us who may have decided to take a breather with our eyes can't, because you do keep us wide awake. So I don't know what kind of slave driver you are, but let's get to Honourable Kamede. And may I say thank you, that is our chairperson of tourism, am I correct?
Yes, Honourable Chair. Where is this Makatini going to now? No, thank you very much for a very, very good presentation from the Department of Trade and Industry. But I just have got two or three short questions. The first one is, we have a memorandum of understanding with China, particularly around the agribusiness, and they are willing to import from us the goods, and then they say that they are not getting any response from South Africa, and yet they are exporting to us. They expect our businesses to be active and export to China, because we raised this in line with our disadvantage in terms of the of our exchange with China. Two, the countries like Brazil, France, and America have developed their military industry and migrated into commercial industry. For instance, the Brazilians are now making buses from their capacities and resources they developed in the military, converted them with the assistance of government into making buses. They are leading in the manufacture of small aircraft, the Brasilia and so forth, that are used between Port Elizabeth and Cape Town and so forth. They developed that. Now, here in South Africa, we have an arms corps, we have a DINEL, which has got quite high capacity. We are manufacturing one of the best helicopters, the Royal Falk, among others, and other vehicles. And I do not know whether we are in the process to migrate from only a limited military capacity into a commercial capacity, and then export, particularly to African countries with a similar climate and a similar terrain, and therefore we can be much more competitive there. And lastly, what are the incentives that are there? It could be in terms of procurement, it could be in terms of rewards or whatever. And that we do have to empower vulnerable communities. By vulnerable communities, I mean rural areas, for instance, rural towns, I mean townships, very urban areas, where there is very, very high employment. But at the same time, you've got things like medicines, you've got things that do not require a high level of skills. and which can be injected in those areas, and they can thrive as well. For instance, manufacturing a cough mixture for Paraguanas Hospital. It's just mixing alcohol and a few ingredients. Then you have you supply Paraguanas, the biggest hospital in the southern half hemisphere, and you manufacture Panados. The patent has expired, so you put those things. You put a pressing machine in Soweto. You export. You use Zanin in the north. You use Mashabatini, or use a small town there which has got a road, electricity, telephone, and these basic the facilities. Are we having plans, or are we already involved in those areas? Because really, South Africa is our unemployment is becoming intolerable, and we have got to make sure that we divide the division of equitable division. We realize that we don't leave things to Pfizer, the big factories only. We some of the factories should enjoy preferential procurement from these big institutions, from the government, and then you use the incubator process for their management and governance and the other processes together with incentives and information. Are there programs like that? And if so, please just indicate. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Gamedi. Thank you so much. Honourable Kwabasa?
Chairperson, my first question is similar to the one asked by Comrade Selau. The one in relation to jobs. One would appreciate a breakdown between the jobs that have been saved through incentives and programs and so on, and jobs that are new in the labor market, so that tells us the extent to which we are creating completely new jobs. One would appreciate that. At the moment, the report is not clear on that. It's too soon. The second question is similar to the one that Comrade Don Gumede is asking. Whether we have plans to move out of the established industrial areas and begin to establish new industries in the rural areas where possible. Coupled with that is the revival of the industries that have lied dormant, closed down, especially in the former Bantustans, but also industries that closed down some time back in the urban areas. The example is Citibank, which is said to have the highest unemployment in Gauteng. Citibank. And there could be a number of other areas like that. So that we begin to spread out into areas that have had to migrate into the cities in order to, for people who have had to migrate into the cities in order to get jobs, so that we also change the social patterns of our society. Because that will contribute to that. Are we having plans to do that? Because that will help us to address to a very significant way the
challenge of unemployment, inequalities, and so on. Lastly, Chairperson, perhaps as part of addressing the challenge of port charges, are we looking into re-establishing our ship manufacturing industry? Because currently we don't have any ship of our own, and perhaps that's part of the reason that we must, besides paying port charges, we must also export our goods through foreign ships and pay even more than that. Yet we have an industry that we have a potential to grow that industry locally, with the advantage of our very long shores and so on, and advanced ports. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kwabasa. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There's some very interesting and debatable economics coming out here, but I'll resist the temptation to engage in that particular debate right now and just pose two very brief questions to the Chief Director for NIP, whose name I forget. Apologies, sir. Mr. Zimela, that's right, Chief Director Zimela. I think it's very encouraging to read that the policy review is coming before Cabinet next week, or to hear that. I wonder when that will be released to the public, if you could let us know about that. Then also, this subject came up earlier this year in about February or March, and at the time, the department, then it was Mr. Zelk, told us that there would be a full review of NIPS with regards to the defense procurement package. And there would be a relook at the policy for industrial participation when it comes to defense procurement. How far is that review? Because that was a separate review to the policy review, and when can we see those documents? And then the third question is fine, actually. That's it.
Thank you very much. Now, I hope then one has been sufficiently generous and to turn to the DDG first and your team.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issues, I'll leave the NIP question to Chief Director Zimela. The issues raised by Honourable Sitoli, absolutely. I think we couldn't agree more. That's why we raised the fact that it's a big problem. It's an intra-governmental problem. There are two things that have to be said. I think we have to avoid the temptation of saying that you will have beneficiation. Either stage one, where you take iron ore and you make it into low-grade steel, through to stage 14, where you're making an advanced manufactured product. If it's simply left to the DTI, as some people suggest it should be, to deploy a range of policy instruments, you won't go anywhere. Yes, policy instruments have to be deployed by the DTR, but the most significant policy instrument is the Minerals Petroleum Resources Development Act, because there are already levers in that, but there is the potential for significant other levers. So if you want a mining license in South Africa, one of the conditionalities, for example, could be that you need to set aside 10% of the iron ore that you export at a developmental price to the steel producer, which has to be passed on to the manufacturers as a development steel price, sorry, a development iron, developmental iron ore price, which must be posed on as a developmental steel price. That's one example. And so the levers exist across government. By the way, we're one of the very few countries that allow unencumbered export of scrap metal. And the scrap metal is being exported from South Africa, mainly to India. It's associated with crime. It's also associated with masking of precious metals into the scrap material. And in a way, it's exporting jobs to India, because if we made that scrap metal available to our steel producers, especially mini mills, then we could have a competitive advantage with respect to niche steel products used in autos, where, by the way, we are exporting even some of the flat steel, niche flat steel used in auto manufacture. So, I mean, you know, the DTI has been singing a song for a very long time, and I think there's progress, but the progress is very slow, and the last remaining potential competitive advantage we have, Member Sitoli, is absolutely that. We sit on the world's biggest resources, especially in key areas, manganese, platinums, and so on and so forth. And in fact, 80% is low. I think we sit on 86%. So, agree with you fully. Honourable Tetsi.
If I could just interrupt, I just want to remind committee members that we are meeting tomorrow at 8. Do you remember our agreement? Eight. Yes. 8 o'clock. So I just need to remind committee members about that issue. Please. Right, can we proceed?
Thank you. Honourable Tsotetsi, I don't think there's a single DTI program or incentive which is not governed by a policy framework informed by the need for transformation. In fact, all the incentives have conditionalities around black economic empowerment linked to the charters and the BEE code. So that goes without saying. We separate the management and deployment of incentives from the policy for very obvious reasons. If we designed the incentive and managed and administered it, you would open the door for conflicts of interest. And so our incentive division, TAO, administers the incentives with the IDC. Honourable Silao, the issue of designation of local jobs for local people, I'm afraid I think you have to raise that matter with the Department of Labour, not the Department of Trade and Industry. Yes, there are some incentives available for foreign direct investment. For example, the 12R tax incentive is available for foreign investors investing in projects. I speak under correction, but I think the threshold is 40 million. It might actually be higher than that, but I could give you the exact figure. And yes, of course, that's an added impetus to secure foreign direct investment into fixed capital foreign direct investment. Not, of course, to buy large retail chains, but to actually invest in manufacturing. Chinese locomotives are being imported, but they're being imported under the customized sector development plans, which is the procurement and supplier development policy framework which governs the state-owned companies, and in similarly to the tender which was given to General Electric, that import is based on a steady increase of local manufacture components for locomotives. Obviously, rolling stock is much easier because you can very quickly ramp up local capacity for the bogies, for the windows, for, you know, the frames. Maybe only some of the electrical components you would need to import, whereas locomotives are very high value added products. But even there, very complex, difficult negotiations are taking place to ensure that those original equipment manufacturers, by the time they produce the 110th locomotive for the South African market, my understanding is that the target is to have 70% localization. I beg your pardon, I've actually skipped in my notes. I'm really sorry. That was Member McIntosh. Just to go back to the questions raised by Member Silao and Member Kwabashi. Kwabasha, I beg your pardon.
Kwa.
No. I'm sure we're having some challenges as well. But it's the Honourable Kwabasa.
Kwabasa. I beg your pardon.
And then that's the Honourable Mabasa. And, you know, so it goes. Right.
We are, as we speak, working on the very difficult problem of how do you capture, monitor, evaluate the impact of a broad range of policy interventions from the DTI, from the IDC, from the Development Bank of South Africa, from the Department of Science and Technology, which has, I think, somewhere in the region of R1 billion a year innovation and technology support incentives. What we can do with ease, because Quantec and the national accounts will give you the global macro picture of how many jobs you're losing, and in some cases, because even there are difficulties to work out how many jobs you are losing or creating in sectors, because the SIG codes don't always equate exactly to our sectors or the IDC sectors for that matter. So you have to do very difficult and detailed firm level studies. And we are doing that together with our incentive division, TEO, together with the IDC, and together with UNIDO to get in place a system which is going to be very expensive and difficult to be able to measure figures with respect to a range of economic indicators, employment, exports, capacity in sectors, key constraints, cost drivers, input costs, and so on and so forth. And so the minister has said repeatedly that in as much as the IPA is, we think, successful as a high-level strategic plan for the deployment of a range of policy instruments, we're going to have to drill down and get a much better firm-level understanding of the impact of the deployment of a range of policy instruments. So we're fully on board. All I would like to say is that it's not as easy as it looks. BER, the Bureau for Economic Research at Stellenbosch, themselves study have very, very significant problems with gathering this kind of data, because you also might have 1,000 employees, and 6 months after the deployment of the incentive, it might have dropped to 900, but they're in the process of upgrading their capacity. In addition to the fact that there are sometimes unintended consequences of incentives where companies lean towards capital intensity and therefore issues of jobs are put on the back burner. Apart from other reasons, upgrading capital equipment does assist in competitiveness upgrading. And so it's a very, very complicated problem. We are working on it. We would hope, Madam Chair, to come back to you next year to be able to report on the research mechanisms that we are putting in place rather than the final results. We're working also closely with the Centre for Strategic Industrial Development Studies at WITS to be able to get on top of this question. With respect to Honourable Salau, who described very interestingly the value chain for the automotive sector, we would agree fully with that approach. And so perhaps to add that one of the weaknesses of the MIDP and the APDP is that perhaps it hasn't given sufficient emphasis to component manufacture, because component manufacture, local component manufacture, is where you can create the most jobs and where you can also rise up the value chain in a particular sector. But it's easier said than done, because these huge original equipment manufacturers, whether it's Daimler-Benz or Mercedes-Benz or whatever, they have global supply chains for components. And so what we want to do is the APDP comes in next year, and we want to have a very quick review of the APDP to try and slant it in the direction of more incentive support for component manufacturers. With respect to the Honourable McIntosh's question, Walmart is not included, but we do know that Walmart has put in place a supplier development program, including with respect to small-scale farmers into their fresh produce, which perhaps with due respect to Massmart and Walmart is probably the easiest supplier development that you can do, because you're basically producing fresh produce for sale. The more difficult supplier development is when you're doing supplier development for a locomotive, because for all the obvious reasons. So the supplier development strategies that we are trying to strengthen in the agro-processing value chains are not only for fresh produce, but packaged and value-added products. And I have to say that Pick and Pay has been a very willing participant in that process. It might be useful at some point.
It's been particularly valuable.
Pick and Pay. It might be useful at some point for Chief Director Hannibal to give you a much more in-depth briefing on the agro-industry sector. The Omar Rust factory is the one that we are referring to. The Stainoff factory in Uchi is part of the upgrading of the furniture and related products. We are about to designate furniture for local procurement because there's been a flood of low quality office furniture imported in South Africa, and our own capacity is being significantly undermined, and we think that the designation of furniture will assist greatly. Although there are constraints manufacturers have fallen behind with respect to issues of design and innovation and use of composite materials, and we have asked the CSIR to come to the table with respect to design issues. And then my understanding, although I'm saying this very guardedly, is that it is the Silverton factory that's being referred to, but I could revert to you once I've checked that. I've answered the Chinese locomotives issue. The tooling is not just the tooling initiative at Nucha. It's also tooling in Boxburg, Benoni, Brakpan, that foundry and tooling conurbation there. With respect to the financial closure on the REAP, I'm afraid to say I'm going to duck that question. I have my own views on it, but it should be answered by the Department of Energy. With respect to the Honourable Gumedi's questions, I haven't seen an MOA with China personally. I know that there have been agreements at a high level, political agreements in terms of the BRIC and bilateral trade agreements. The only thing that I can speak with a certain degree of certainty with is that the first trade fair, which was held in Shanghai, at which South African manufacturers exhibited, the Minister of Trade and Industry had said unequivocally that we don't want a trade fair which is simply people off the street coming into the trade fair and, you know, you don't actually get any orders, and that Chinese procuring entities should be brought to the trade fair. And my understanding, I speak under correction, Madam Chair, is that the first trade fair resulted in orders of 400 million for manufactured products from South Africa, which is relatively small, but it's a significant start. And as we speak now, the minister's just come back from China and the director general is in China, and the impression I get is that there are significant opportunities and that the political relations with China are cascading down into real commitments to change the profile of the trade regime away from the export of primary commodities. With respect to the defense industry, obviously Danel and Armsco are the key players. We have a very small role to play as the DTR, and that role is in an area where we have considerable global competitive advantages. To give you an indication, as a result of work done in a partnership between the CSIR and local manufacturers, actually Masazaki might be able to speak to this because it involved NIP offsets. There have been significant production capacity established, and in my understanding the bulkheads for the A380 Airbus will be composites made in South Africa. The DTR funds the Centurion Aerospace Village, and the minister recently asked for an assessment of whether or not, as it is at the moment, the incentives exclude certain defense industry products under various SIC codes, and there is a request that we should look at including some of those products where they are global. We have global competitive capabilities, including with respect to drones, which don't only have military applications but have game, anti-poaching, hydrology, and other applications. So that's the subject of a study as we speak. Pharmaceuticals, Honourable Gumede, I'm not sure. The ITED's classification of value addition puts pharmaceuticals in the highest category of skills, capital intensity, and technology, which is not to say that certain pharmaceuticals can't be, maybe cough mixture, I don't know enough about the sector, can't be produced at a kind of SME level, but certainly where you've got economies of scale for very high value in the sense of patents and intellectual property, these products are produced by very big multinational companies. We do have, however, very significant capabilities in South Africa, and the designation of pharmaceuticals for local procurement has been met with, in my understanding, significant support from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and we are looking to work closely with the Department of Health to ramp up the thresholds of local procurement. But you have to be very careful because there are important issues of security of supply. And so if you designate for 100% and the hospitals run out of a particular much-needed pharmaceutical product, then you'll obviously be in trouble. So we approach that, especially when it comes to ARVs, we approach that issue with extreme caution for obvious reasons. I've answered part of the Honourable Khwabase's question. With respect to regional industrial decentralization, it's a complex question. There is a chief directorate working on this question, and they are working closely with the SEZs. The National Treasury has set aside, I think it's 3.8 billion rand over 5 years for the SEZ program. The legislation, I understand, is soon to go before the National Parliament, and central to the SEZ program, which would be regional decentralization strategies, which, by the way, haven't really worked very well in other parts of the world. And you mentioned the Bantustans. Those were sustainable for a very short period of time because they were the subject of significant, basically, Bantustan subsidies. Once those subsidies fell away, when the new government removed spatial subsidies, those companies could no longer be competitive, and many of them have gone to the wall. I'm not arguing against a spatial subsidies. On the contrary, those will be included in the SEZs, although we need to be very careful, because unless you put strong conditionalities into your SEZ incentive program, you could have a company relocating from Kempton Park to the Saldanha Bay SEZ simply to get the incentive, but it could simply be translocating capacity from one part of South Africa to another and not creating additional jobs. So I'm trying to give you an example of the fact that it's a very complicated process which we need to be careful of. With respect to shipbuilding, that program, in fact, is under Chief Director Napai. We have, I think, been reasonably successful in one subsector, and that is the luxury yacht multi-hull recreational subsector, where we have global competitiveness with respect to charter yachts and luxury yachts, much of it based in Cape Town, but also Durban and increasingly in the Eastern Cape. We have deployed a sector-specific boat-building incentive, which enables those companies to be able to leverage financing so that they have one boat at the Miami Boat Show or the Le Havre Boat Show and another one being built on the production line. And we want to use the experience of that to move beyond that subsector into working boats, which would be small tugboats, pilot boats, shore to ship, shore to oil and gas rig. And in fact, there are some very significant competitive advantages we have. There's a company in Cape Town called Whale Marine, which I think has won export orders to Latin America, and they have an onboard diesel jet engine and a Kevlar hull and superstructure, which has applications in oil and gas as well as anti-piracy and policing. So the answer to the question is that we are in the process of ramping up our very specific boat building sector strategy to a wider small working ship building and repair capacity, and perhaps get those right and then see whether we can make the bigger jump into bigger ship repair. The reality is that there is a binding constraint. Durban is not log jammed, but it's very, very full. Cape Town similarly, and one of the problems is to get the right infrastructure into Saldanha and Richards Bay to be able to support a boat and small ship building capacity. And that requires infrastructure investment, quays, testing facilities, heavy lift cranes, and dry dock facilities. So I think it's a very, very useful question. We are working on it. I'm not sure it will be ready for the next IPAP, but if not this coming one, the one after that. Could I perhaps hand over the questions on the NIP to my colleague?
Chief Director Zameli.
Thanks, Chair. The policy, the NIP policy review that is before the cabinet at the moment, basically, as Zukiswa said in the presentation, it seeks to align NIP with the other procurement levers, the designation, the fleets, the competitive supply development program managed by DPE. And it also seeks to strengthen the application of NIP and its effective contribution to industrial development. The guidelines are being drafted. If it's approved by the cabinet, we'll finalize the guidelines through the DTI structure. They need to be signed off by the minister. Once it's signed off by the minister, we'll release it to the public. Then on the military, the issue that Garth was talking about, one of the things that we're doing with the review of with this policy review is we talk now about the moving towards more of the direct NIP. As you may know that most of the SDP of the offsets were on NIP, which was all more on civilian projects. What we're trying to do, on the deep defense side, there will always be DIP, which is managed by Arms Corps and NIP. But what we're trying to do on the NIP side is to move towards the dual components that will apply on all the obligations arising out of NIP, like things like radar systems, communication systems, that could be applied in civilian areas as well. But the question on the FDP review, it's being done by the DTI internal audit. My estimate is that we're a quarter of the way in terms. We did say last time we talked about NPA that we estimate that we'll complete by the end of March. I think we're still on track for that, but we'll continue to review progress and see if we'll meet those deadlines. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chief Director. DDG? Right. Members, I'm only looking at those very urgent ones, and ahead of you, Honourable Hill Salah, you've got me totally confused because you see I'm trying to point to Honourable Salah, but Honourable Hill Lewis was Honourable Salah. Do you recall that?
Yes, it was.
And then you'll be able to do your little one after him.
I just wanted to...
But that's what I mean. He also just wanted... He's just, you know... you were saying you wanted another question.
Yes, Chairman.
Do you have another question? Do you have another one? That's the issue.
Yes, manage.
Yes.
Manage is the question. Three major retailers on page 12 of your presentation. Dash number 3 from the top. Three major retailers are participating in CTCP for shady through with an EdCon. At some point in one of the presentations, we were made to believe that's Woolworths. So then I'm getting Woolworths, I'm getting EdCon. I'm not sure which one has been sealed, which one is still under negotiations. The second one is the Munyetla program. I might be ignorant. It has been presented maybe either when I was not there, but I don't know what Munyetla program is doing. Now, when you say it's a key achievement, there are these particular young trainees in the Munyetla, 17% placed in the BPS consortium. I don't understand because I don't know what Munyetla is doing. And the last one is, I marked them, and others I have dealt away with. The last one is the inadequacy. It's page 18. It's called inadequate provision of suitable long-term financing instruments for the industry. That's a challenge. Then the question is, what do we mean by inadequate in this context?
I just should add that there's a full report on Munyetla in the DTI trade report, annual report, just as a matter of fact. But I think the other two are important issues for clarification, Honourable Salah. Honourable Hill Lewis, you're doing a follow-up, and that's the last.
It's just a comment to Honourable Gumede. You'll be very interested to read, I think it's the latest Financial Mail, has got a full report on the South African defense industry and what they're doing to drive export growth. It's really interesting. It's a great read.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I know that the Parliamentary Liaison Officer for DTI, Ms. Naidu, could easily make it available to you. And I'm sure we'll be able to get the email, etc. And those are very helpful, you know, just getting that on the relevant issues. I must thank you. I just would like to add something, DDG Strachan, and that is, you spoke about all the skills that we need, etc., and you'd be the first to say, look, when I say you, DTI, if we've got the skills here, we don't want to bring them in, you know, per se, if we've got sufficient. But when our people are being employed already by industry, manufacturing, whatever, and then they are given the opportunity which they take, 3 months, 6 months, whatever, in Germany, Switzerland, France, China, you name it, that is not recognized by us. It's absolutely not recognized. So they come back then having achieved, and they now the something-something engineer, if I could put it that way, but not recognized by us. And I think that this is a great pity, I think, in view of the point you yourself have made. We need these specialist skills. Let's recognize them. And let's try to look at the impediments to that particular process so that we don't hold people back unnecessarily. Can I put it that way? I thought you were going to just wait for your response, Honorable Hildus, but I know you wanted to just give a piece of information. Over to you, DDG.
Questions. For Shini Truworth and Edcon, that is in the clothing textiles sector, where those companies have agreed and entered into a relationship with manufacturers to procure locally. And that was facilitated by the DTI. I think it sets the standard for what these companies can do to support local manufacturers. The commitments of the private sector are enshrined in the procurement accord. I think our view is that, with some exceptions, the commitments given by the private sector to local procurement relative to the significant progress government has made is disappointing. It is for this reason that a set of processes has been put in place. Even though it's the works led by EDD to try to persuade industry associations and companies, big procuring companies, to procure locally. So to give you one example, we've met with the Chamber of Mines. There is import penetration of mining capital and transport equipment. Sometimes it's substandard. We went to a factory in Benoni, which makes gears which are 15 meters wide for the energy and mining sector. It's one of only four companies in the world that can make those gears, but some mining companies are importing them, and ironically, this company's main line of profit is now servicing the gears which were imported from China, because the Chinese manufacturer doesn't have after-sales service. So that gives you one example of why supplier development, procuring locally, working with the local producer to give you what you want with a fast turnaround time, be able to service the product, makes not only sense for the nation in terms of job creation, but it also makes sense, we think, commercially, because supplier development has important commercial considerations as well. Woolworths Pick and Pay, the reference to those companies applies to the agro-processing value chain, so you know, perhaps we shouldn't confuse the two. As the Honourable Chairperson has said, the Monietla is outlined in our report, safe to say the fact that we think it's a good example of combining policy instruments. So we have investment promotion to secure investments from business processing outsourcing companies, Amazon being one, to come into the country. You deploy a set of incentives. is a shortage of skills for call centers. That's essentially what they are. So together with the National Treasury and the private sector, the National Business Institute, we put in place a demand-side training, which says what is the training that's required by these companies that have come into South Africa? Can we put in place training capacity to match the need with the supply? And it's worked very well, and we think we as the DTI can't get into this big space of the CETAs and all the big training, but what we can get involved in is training around clusters and hubs and demand-side training for particular sectors and hubs. And the Monyetla would, we think, be a very good example of a successful one, as well as the National Tooling Initiative, which, as I said, we don't have the exact figures, and it's not my call to make this announcement, but it's been so successful that we're leveraging very significant support from the Department of Higher Education and Training. The long-term financing, I think I had answered that question, which essentially relates. Madam Chair, I couldn't agree with you more with respect to the work permits issue. By the way, international research suggests that where you import very scarce skills, you actually create jobs. And so the key is to identify what are the very scarce skills and work closely with Home Affairs to allow that process to happen. Obviously, it can't be at the expense of local job seekers where those skills exist.
So, DDG, we really must thank you and your team. A team, of course, being chief directors, Kafai, as well as Zimela and yourself, for really a very valuable presentation that you shared with us here, which brought us up to speed in a number of areas and complements the annual report of the DTI and entities, etc. But, you know, when we study it, etc., I know that there will be further issues that will come up, and we hope that during the course of our public hearings, you, I know, will be here, among others from DTI, we will still be able to engage in these areas and so on. And you would have got a taste of what they are. I was just thinking on the pharmaceutical side, cough mixtures, my local chemist concocts it, so it can't be that difficult, and sells it at one-fifth of the price of the whatever else is on the shelf. And got huge queues, you know, all coming in, especially in winter, for Ama, you know, your own cough mixture. Ah, you know, and then you get it. But so I think, you know, we need to explore these areas. But on the other hand as well, I think that some of the reports, we've heard the steel, iron ore steel issue, and people who've been in the committee are well aware that we have asked the DTI, who is only now one of the departments involved, if I'm right, Honourable Khadebe, in this process of unpacking the pricing, the development price, etc., to send it on through to our manufacturers, that I believe the report is probably before Cabinet, as I understand. And we would hope that we may get it while the IPAP hearings are on. I don't know. And I am going to ascertain whether or not that will be forthcoming. I really don't know that timeline. But we will ascertain. But clearly they've done a very sound job in that respect. But I thought that the Minister had indicated that with respect to the Saldanha mill, steel mill, you had Absalom Mittal there in not as the kingpin, but one of many. Am I right? In the Saldana deal, no. I don't know, and I just want to clarify that.
I'm not sure I understand the question, Madam Chair, but the Saldana mill is exclusively Okolo Mittal.
I wondered if the practices had changed there, because that was always mentioned separately, the Saldana steel mill, you see. So I just wondered if it had a different approach to doing things. But I'm sure you'll be able to come back to us with that kind of information in this regard. Because it is our intention to ask them what they're doing about the skills transfer, apprenticeships and that kind of thing, which they indicated 2 years ago, you know, they were bent on transforming. But having said that, I think that we certainly going to factor in the ports for the public hearings. That's a really key area. I think that the administrative prices, it may well, members, mean that we should consult Treasury in this regard, because in fact many of the administrative prices, they would have the information. Am I correct, DDG? Or is it
probably,
or is it public?
In relation to the ports, it would be DPE.
Administered prices generally.
They would probably have a very good understanding of the full basket of administered prices.
Well, that's useful. I did speak to the Minister of DPE yesterday. He expressed an interest. I think we ought to see whether or not he can come, or the DG, or, you know, the relevant person in that particular regard. So I just raise this now because some of these issues have come up, and I think they're going to be very important that we tackle, especially having heard what you have shared with us. But I must say we really appreciated you coming at this particular time, the staff preparing such a sound presentation for us. Thank you very much to the department. To other chairs and members who attended, and I know, Honourable Ntuli, you'll pass this on, I think that while they can't always avail themselves of every opportunity during the public hearings, they may well be able to send a member, you know, from a particular committee, and so that that can be shared with the respective committees and clusters in that regard. Because indeed, IPAP is not just simply a trade and industry issue. And I think we need to understand that. It is actually across, it's overarching. And we do need everyone to come to the party. But to our very committed members, I know many of us have got political commitments. I know many of us are not well. I know that. But yet you did remain here, and I really want to thank all of you, because this was a very important presentation and sharing. So I do want to thank each one of you for making the time to be here. Thank you to everyone. It's adjourned for the committee until 8 a.m. In which committee room?